I was brokenhearted this past week. About 50 years ago, an old school pal I played golf with regularly gave me a ball marker. That's one of those small discs that you put on the green to mark your golf ball before you putt. And I've gone and lost it. It had no money value at all, but I've used it for 50 years. And perhaps you know something of what I mean. Perhaps you know, too, the wrench when you have to say goodbye to a cat or a dog. And when we lose a person, our sense of devastation can be almost unbearable. Ask any widow or orphan, or divorcee. What enriches life so much becomes the greatest tragedy when we lose what we have loved. And as we come to these chapters 13, 14, and 15 of John, and we're going to be looking at them between now and Easter, just such a tragedy is about to hit the disciples. Jesus is sharing supper with these close friends. This is the last meal they will have together. And the dark premonition of separation hangs over all their conversation. The disciples are bewildered and they are frightened. And he challenges them, "Love one another." But then the ominous past tense, "as I have loved you." And he keeps on using the word "going." And no wonder these chapters are called the Farewell Discourse. Today, I'd like us to look at two questions asked by Peter and Thomas. And each says something about the man asking the question. And each has its own slant on their anxiety. We go back into chapter 13 for Peter's question, verse 36. "Lord, where are you going?" "Where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will later." "Why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Quite often, the first stage of grief is denial, a refusal to accept bad news. And an example today might be, "It can't be true what the doctor is saying." Peter is the excitable type. "Why can't I follow you now?" And the thought of separation is bringing out almost a childish petulance in him. But don't let's blame him for that. Desperation in loss can change us quickly. And this man was devoted to Jesus. At the same time, there's danger in some of Peter's words. "I will lay down my life for you." "No, Lord," he's saying, "you mustn't die for me. I want to die for you." And we can see almost the flicker of a smile on Jesus' face at this bravado. The words sound grand, but there's a touch of pride there too, wanting to show superiority. And the same thing had in fact appeared with Peter earlier that same evening. "No, Lord, you shall never wash my feet." And pride is the one passion that Jesus cannot allow in any disciple. And so Jesus answers Peter's boast by predicting Peter's coming denial before the cock crows. This brave disciple will very soon despise himself. It's going to be a long, hard night for Peter. But he has to learn something vital, as does every one of us. Jesus does not love us because we are faithful to him, not even because we are willing to die for him. He loves us in spite of the fact that we are disloyal weaklings. And let us never forget it. Now, maybe there are times when you feel that you have failed as a Christian. One of our mission partners comes here on a Sunday, and you think, oh, to be committed like that. They're all so much keener than I am. Or you go to your home group and you come away feeling inadequate compared with some of them. And if you've ever felt like that, dazzled by the halos around you, then I know that I'm in good company too. Take heart, though. Jesus isn't looking for finished perfection in you any more than he wanted it in Peter. The first thing that he wants in any of us is trust. Chapter 14, verse 1. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust in me also. And these are the reassuring words that I am asked to read and to speak on in many of the funerals I take. But notice, please, they were first spoken to a group of men who, under intense emotional battering, were about to fail. They were about to run away. And Jesus knew what they were going to do. But he is encouraging them not to be weighed down by that coming failure. He wants them to know that hope will overcome that failure. And that this Christianity that he's been teaching them is not based on what they can do for him, but on what he is about to do for them. Trust in me. And then, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And he might have added, yes, even for you, Peter. Now, that phrase, many rooms, many mansions, as it is in older Bible versions, it's given rise to some speculation. Some like to see it as an estate of Buckingham palaces waiting there for us in heaven. By far the most satisfying meaning for me is that in heaven there is room enough for every Christian. Peter is not to worry, and nor are we. Heaven doesn't mean an entrance exam where you have to show yourself better than others in order to get one of those limited places on offer. It's not a competition only for heroes and martyrs. Heaven is simply my Father's house. It's home. It's where you belong. And you can hear him saying, trust God and trust me. I know what I'm talking about. And he goes on as though to say something like this. If there was any possibility of any disciple of mine forfeiting his right to heaven, then I would have told you about it. You can take my word. There is a place there for every Christian believer. And it's to confirm that place of yours, that's why I'm leaving you now. And that is why there is no need to despair if I do leave you. This parting is not forever. But until we meet again, you have to trust me. I'm going to come back to take you where I am going. But you have to trust me all through those tears of failure and the darkness of loss. That Old Testament reading that Jamie read to us, it made the same point. Trust the Lord with all your heart and don't rely on your own understanding. We must trust God, not only that he does what is best, but that he knows what is best. And in the Bible, he has told us what we need to do. So that is question and answer for Peter. Verse 5. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? If the reaction of some to loss is denial, others are more morbid, and they tend to lapse into a bit of depression. And I suspect Thomas was rather like that. He strikes me as being something of a pessimist. He doesn't understand all this business about Jesus' going. And I think I can see him shrugging his shoulders. We have no idea where you're going, so how can we know how to follow you? It was all rather pointless for Thomas. But at least good marks for honesty. I know one or two people, and perhaps you do too, who would never, ever admit to being perplexed about anything. They know it all. And Thomas could so easily have pretended to understand. Quite so, Jesus. We're right behind you. And don't take any notice of Peter. He's just showing off as usual. At least Thomas is candid enough to say that he does have a problem. And Jesus' reply suggests he respects that kind of integrity. Someone once said, there is more faith in honest doubt than in half the creeds. And Jesus doesn't look down on you if you don't know. Verse 6, Jesus answers Thomas, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Keep in mind, please, that Thomas, like many after him, finds it hard to imagine the next world as a place to go to or to understand how anybody gets there. And perhaps, and again, like so many today, he needs concrete material certainties, not abstract ideas. Where is this Father's house? 2,000 years later, he might have asked to be beamed up like Captain Kirk to his starship Enterprise. Let's face it, Jesus, we don't know anything about this heaven that you're talking about, so how can we believe in it, let alone find our way there? And then comes the staggering, the mind-blowing reply, I am the way. No one comes to the Father but by me. Now, do you see what Jesus is doing? He is focusing on a person, not a place. Instead of the Father's house, he tells Thomas about himself. Instead of a road to heaven, he himself is that road. And put another way, look, Thomas, you want to turn my words into something literal. If you find it hard to think of heaven as a place, then think of it instead as a person. And that person, Thomas, is someone who, far from being unknown to you, is in fact very familiar. It's me, Thomas. Think of heaven as me. Thomas's problem was the same as that of many of us. We don't really know Jesus Christ. We're rather like someone locked out of our car, and all the time the keys are there, jangling in our pocket. Thomas did know the way. He was looking straight at him. Heaven wasn't a place to plan a journey to. It's a relationship that Thomas already has. And if there is anyone here this morning who has Thomas's skepticism, today we might call it agnosticism, then this is hugely relevant for you. First of all, you have to take Jesus seriously. But you might say, well, of course, there are so many different faiths around, aren't there? How am I expected to know which one is the right one? Assuming that is that one of them is right. And to you, I need to say this, please. Jesus will not allow that sort of evasiveness. I am the way. So then, what about other faiths? Will there be believers of other religions in heaven? And I accept it's a huge question with enormous implications. But my job is to try to teach you what the Bible says. And to me, this verse makes it clear. There will be no one in heaven claiming that the way there is through Muhammad or the Buddha. There is only one chorus of praise there. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain. There is no way to the Father other than through Jesus. His is an exclusive claim. And that is why you have to take him very seriously. Now, to say this today, of course, is to be accused of intolerance. Why can't I be more civilized and accept those who think differently? Jesus was, in fact, a champion of tolerance. He was tolerant of these very disciples who were about to abandon him. Tolerant of all the crowds who misunderstood him, and tolerant too of you and me when we fail him time and time again. But in this one area of salvation, he is firm and unwavering. There are not several roads, just the one. And that road is Jesus himself. Now, I know it may be easier for our world to look on him as just one of various options. But that idea is itself no option. There are, of course, any number of questions that the Bible doesn't specifically answer for us as well as for Thomas. What about those people, you'll know many of them, who say that they are not Christians, and yet they have hearts of true gold, much kinder than most of the Christians we know. What happens to them? Or to the millions in our world who will live and die without ever hearing the name Jesus Christ? Or the millions who lived before Jesus who never heard about him? What happens to them? And some people reckon to have satisfactory answers to questions like that. I don't. I do, however, believe that there are answers in heaven to every problem and every doubt. And one day we shall know those answers. Meantime, think about this. Meantime, could it be that if we did know all the answers right now, there would be nothing left about which to trust Jesus? And more than anything, He wants that trust. If you insist on a full, satisfactory answer to every query you have before you agree to call yourself a Christian, you will never find faith. You will die, as you are now, a spiritual don't-know. Jesus doesn't offer answers to every philosophical question. What he does is to offer himself. An ultimate truth is not arrived at by logic or by intellect. It is not for clever people only. The truth behind this universe is personal. It's a person. It is Jesus Christ. And so you gain that truth in the only way a person can ever be won over. By trust, by love. Now, it could be that you look on that as rather a gamble. And maybe you're right. But then perhaps all personal relationships begin as a gamble. If you have stood in a church and said, "I will," to someone at your side, at that moment, you don't know the future, and it may well turn out to be a gamble. And Jesus invites you to take your gamble on him. He doesn't want you to switch off your intellect from that moment, nor do you have to instantly believe everything that Christians are supposed to believe. To begin with, all he asks is that you trust him and that you are willing to see in him the answers to all your doubts. And indeed, he is saying that without him, we have no chance of finding answers at all. I am the way and the truth and the life. Thank God for it.